is on the general topic of man's nature and origin. And again, our suggested questions for discussion. First, what is the difference between nature and grace? What is the difference between nature and grace? Number two, what are some popular current misconceptions about original sin? What are some popular current misconceptions about original sin? Three, how can concupiscence be explained in today's terminology? How can concupiscence be explained in today's terminology? Four, how should evolution be taught so as to be consistent with Catholic belief and current with present-day thought? How should evolution be taught so as to be consistent with Catholic belief and current with present-day thought? Five, are evil moral tendencies inherited? Are evil moral tendencies inherited? And six, how much does environment determine moral conduct? How much does environment determine moral conduct? Now we address ourselves to a massive subject. First of all, by way of introduction, consistent with our general attitude during the seminar, I wish to isolate certain features of a large theological area for special attention. What we will discuss is being chosen either because these issues are most controverted today or because they indicate points of theological development. Accordingly, I plan to touch on four out of many possible issues that belong to the broad subject of man's origin, nature, and destiny. Specifically, I wish to deal with, first, the theology of sin. Secondly, an analysis of concupiscence. Third, the theory of polygenism. And fourth, evolution and the primitive man. These issues are not of equal objective importance, but all somehow enter into the field of present-day theological thinking and need to be clarified and wisely understood, always in the spirit of the Catholic faith. First, then, the theology of sin. Any approach to the subject of sin should begin with the unspoken premise which underlies the very concept of sin, namely the absolute need that man has of grace. Without this, man's need of grace being first understood, the meaning of sin is inevitably distorted and twisted, completely out of shape. Not a small part of the current difficulty that people have with accepting the notion of sin is their inability to see sin as a privation of grace. Understand man's need of grace, and you have gone a long way toward explaining the meaning of sin. First, a short workable definition of grace. Grace is a divine favor that gives man what he needs to reach his eternal destiny. Grace, in this sense, answers to the familiar biblical words, charis, charis, in Greek, from which the English word charity is obviously derived, or the Latin gratia, which is the basis for our etymological Latin word, grace. Before examining and answering the question, why man needs the grace of God, and in what sense men are sinners, it will be useful to review the principal positions that have been taken in the centuries of the Church's history, antithetical to Catholic Christianity on this subject. There have been five such positions in Christian history, and whatever else we should know in theology, it is that history keeps repeating itself. The first challenge to the Christian belief in man's need of grace for salvation through Christ was Manichaeism. Manichaeism postulated an objective metaphysical dualism in man. Metaphysical because it claimed that man's very existence depended on the cosmic struggle between two deities, the good deity who brought his spirit into being, and the evil God responsible for man's body. The conflict within man, therefore, is only a reflection of the greater conflict outside of man among the gods, or if you wish, between the gods. By implication, Manichaeism denied that the conflict we experience is a moral dualism. These words are, if technical, not trivial. Metaphysical dualism, that's Manichaeism. Moral dualism, that's us. It denied that the conflict we experience is a moral dualism, namely, one arising from a deliberate perversion of created will. When Augustine finally broke with the Manichaeans, it was over the discovery that he, and not some outside evil deity who was ultimately responsible for his misdeeds. Once he discovered that, he became a Christian. There is no room for grace in Manichaeism as a free gift from God. In the last analysis, man's destiny depends on the outcome of the cosmic struggle going on outside of him. It is not because of divine assistance with which man can cooperate. Manichaeism is basically determinism. Most of the philosophical Western society today is Manichaean. Second, in the historical lineage, antithetical to Catholic Christianity, was Pelagian naturalism. Pelagianism was, in a way, the obverse of Manichaeism. There was only one God in the Pelagian system, but he never raised man to a higher than natural destiny. Man, therefore, had no need of grace, since he was never elevated to the supernatural order. Yet, perhaps unexpectedly, Pelagius admitted man's fall in Adam, but only externally, in that Adam set his progeny a bad example. The offspring of Adam did the same for their descendants, and so on into the whole of human society. But mankind did not essentially lose anything, because of Adam's fall, for the simple reason that they had nothing to lose, neither friendship with God, sanctifying grace, which they had never received in the first place, nor preternatural gifts, notably integrity, or bodily integrity. The only grace allowed in Pelagianism was external, somehow psychological and exemplary. And in this sense, Christ may be called the Savior of mankind, since he reversed by his good example the downward process in society that was started by Adam's bad example. Most of the current thinking in still nominally Catholic circles today, contradictory to the historic teaching of the Church on original sin, is Latter-day Pelagianism. The third historic system, classic Protestantism. The original reformers, especially Calvin, opted for the Pelagian idea that man had never been supernaturally elevated or destined for a heaven that was above the native capacities of mankind to attain by his native powers, provided man had not sinned in Adam. But the reformers, unlike the Pelagians, not only admitted that Adam had sinned, which the Pelagians did admit, or that his sin somehow affected Adam's progeny. The effect of that primordial fall, according to the reformers and all their descendants, insofar as they are faithful to classic Protestantism, the effect on man they taught and teach was devastating. It literally denuded man of his native power of freedom of will to do anything spiritually good in the eyes of God. It is important to add that the full development of this theory of man's sinfulness and incapacity for true freedom did not come until much later. Protestantism taught it, teaches it, but the full theological understanding of Protestantism came under Jansenius. The Bishop of Ypres adopted Calvinism, clarified it, and expressed it in terms that were familiar in Catholic theology. Jansenism is a live system with its own hierarchy in the Netherlands and very active in the ecumenical movement among the Dutch and elsewhere. The Dutch Catechism is the fruit of 3 centuries of Jansenism. The fourth historical system, antithetical to Catholic Christianity, secularist humanism. Since the rise of deism in the 16th century, a neo-Pelagianism has appeared which borrows from the Pelagians their absolute confidence in man's ability to reach his destiny by himself without divine grace. but it goes beyond the Pelagians in reducing man's purpose in life to this worldly goals. Hence, it is secularism from saeculum, the world, and of man by his own native powers, man, homo, or the adjective humanus, hence humanism. The fifth and last antithetical system to Catholic Christianity on man's need of grace, and therefore in what sense he is a sinner. At the other extreme, in the line of Manichaeism, is the modern pessimism, the other extreme to secularist humanism, which is equally secularistic as secularist humanism, but tends in the opposite direction. Instead of unbounded confidence that man can make it alone, it has no confidence that man can attain his destiny, if he has any, either in the life to come, if there is one, or even in this life, as experience commonly teaches. I think the best piece of modern literature, which beautifully synthesizes present-day naturalist pessimism, is The Death of a Salesman. This position is negative twice over. Once in denying man's elevation to a higher than natural end, the heaven of Christian faith, and again, in denying that he has access to divine assistance in reaching whatever goal he may have even in this life. Now to summarize the teaching of Catholic Christianity in its own way as antithetical to the five adversative systems we have just described. I won't make an apology for spending 20 minutes on laying the groundwork of the theology of grace, because it is impossible to understand either man's sinfulness or his need of God, because he is a sinner, except in the context of grace. Unlike the foregoing, Catholic Christianity has taught the following. As regards man's nature, destiny, and the means he needs to attain his end. And in each case, we will look back for a moment at each of the adversative systems just described. First, contrary to Manichaeism, Catholic Christianity teaches there is only one God, creator of all things, including man. The dualism in man as the conflict of which everyone is painfully conscious is a moral dualism. That is, it was produced by man's own intrusion of freedom contrary to the will of God. It is not due to any cosmic competition between conflicting deities. Second, contrary to Pelagianism, man was originally gifted beyond the rights of human nature, supernaturally with divine friendship and preternaturally with integrity and bodily immortality. These gifts were lost through the sin of Adam. Through Christ, the second Adam, the supernatural life is restored, but the loss of integrity and bodily immortality remain to be, please God, one day restored. Thirdly, Unlike classic Protestantism and Jansenism, the fall of man is not believed to have completely vitiated his nature. It deprived him of the gifts he originally received, but it left him basically intact in his native powers, though weakened in their exercise. Man is deprived. There is an I in the word. He is not essentially depraved with an A in the word. Fourth, alien to secularist humanism, man is believed to have a celestial destiny, which means the attainment of God in the beatifying vision, that is, the intuitive vision of God, which confers a happiness that only God has a natural right to enjoy. That's why it's supernatural, because it is natural only to God. This destiny cannot be achieved except through grace. Man is naturally insufficient to attain heaven. Fifth and finally, alien to naturalist pessimism, Catholic Christianity holds that in spite of the struggle within him, man can succeed in achieving the goal of his existence through divine help. His purpose in life is not only to struggle, but to be happy in this life and to be perfectly happy in the life to come. But neither the mixed happiness of earth nor the perfect happiness of heaven is attainable by man's powers alone. He needs the constant help of God over and above his native ability. Now we enter the subject directly to ask why man needs grace. Yet before answering the question, you know how, or you see how concerned I am to make sure we have all the premises. It is necessary to point out that the historical or empirical reason why we need grace is the fact that we are sinners. But the fundamental reason is that we are creatures. No single statement of the Catholic faith is more critical or more distinctive of Catholicism than this one. The fundamental reason why we need grace is not because we are sinners, but because we are creatures. This distinguishes Christianity from all other religions. There's nothing like it. And within Christianity, from all other approximations. The essential reason, therefore, that we need grace is our creaturehood. The existential reasons are consequent on the essential one, and they are three. Man's original deprivation, secondly, his personal sinfulness, and thirdly, a social susceptibility to sinful influences. I went into this background because I think without it, without a good, broad, clear base, the developments in Catholic theology on sin, original sin, and the theology of grace are difficult, if not impossible, to understand. This, I think, is the main reason why so many otherwise literate theologians speak sometimes so foolishly. Something about each of these three needs for grace, all existential. First of all, our original deprivation. Let's first recall and reassure ourselves that the Church's teaching on original sin has not changed. What the Church taught in early centuries at the Council of Carthage and Orange, at the time of the Reformation and the Council of Trent, it now teaches in the Second Vatican Council. Let me quote from the two sentences in the Constitution of the Church in the Modern World, the first chapter, number 13. Original sin is still with us. Quote, Second Vatican. Although man was established by God in a state of holiness, from the very dawn of history, he abused his liberty at the urging of the evil one. Man set himself against God and sought to find fulfillment apart from God. Unquote, Second Vatican. By the way, we did mention, didn't we, that Abbott's translation of the Second Vatican Council is untrustworthy. Here is one place where the translation is tendentious. Instead of saying what the Latin says, from the very dawn of history, man abused his liberty at the urging of the evil one, do you know what the Abbott translation says? At the suggestion of personified evil. Personified evil is ambiguous. It's the evil one. It's the devil. The fall of man added a new dimension to man's need of grace. Where creaturehood postulates the necessity of divine favor to raise man to the dignity of godliness, so he may enjoy heaven, the primordial fall indicates another kind of necessity. If being elevated to the supernatural life implies the exercise of God's love, the restoration of man after he fell implies the exercise of God's mercy. God, though he is God, would never have had, let alone exercised, the attribute of mercy unless his creatures had sinned. Moreover, if man requires grace to reach the beatific vision, this necessity is essential. Keep that always on one side. Whereas the need of grace after losing God's friendship is existential, it depends on the historical fact of man's deviation from the appointed will of God. We might compare the two forms of necessity to a man or a sister who needs $100 to go on a journey, say from Chicago to New York, or say from Cleveland to Chicago. Needing this money is essential. Suppose he or she loses it before he buys his plane or railroad tickets. His need then becomes, over and above the first necessity, an obvious empirical or existential fact. This is not all. Since the primeval fall from grace, Man has become conscious of his incompleteness in a way that would not have been true if he had not fallen. He is now aware of something missing in his makeup, not unlike the condition of a person who is sick. Until he became ill, he hardly paid attention to his health. It was simply there. Now he is painfully sure something is wrong and looks about for a remedy because he knows that without help, he cannot be normal again. Applying the comparison to man's situation since the fall, he learns from experience. He doesn't even need a revelation to know this. And from the experience of others, even if faith did not tell him what happened to human nature, somewhere in the dim past, he knows, terribly knows, things are not what they should be. Above all, he sees in himself all sorts of fears and desires that claim attention and want expression. Yet if the fears are not controlled or the desires restrained, chaos results. A single unrestrained urge like sex can destroy his whole personality. Faith tells him that the loss was on two levels, with further consequences on a third. When he now comes into the world, he is bereft of that internal gift called the divine life, which enables him to perform actions worthy of celestial beatitude. One. Secondly, he further is